Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 71st Venice Film Festival, and I'm joined by Rüdiger Zuchsland, who is presenting his film Von Caligari zu Hitler.
Hello.
From Caligari to Hitler. That's the translation. Thanks very much for taking the time off.
Yeah, hello.
Okay, so I think the best way to introduce the film is to let you tell our listeners what it's about.
Well, it's about Weimar cinema. It's about the relation between films and cultural and social events in the 1920s, most of all. The Weimar Republic is the first German republic. It started with the revolution immediately after the lost First World War in 1918, and it lasted till January of 1933, which is the moment when Hitler came to power. So quite often in Germany, until now, by historians, this republic is seen as to be something like a prehistory of Hitler, and everything is very bad because Hitler, at the end, the evil master, came to power. But I think, as the human beings living in that time, they didn't know what would come out, even in late 1932. Mm-hmm. So a lot more was possible than Hitler. I don't believe in necessities in history. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were causes and reasons for Hitler, and we can see them in the film. So there was a film critic quite famous in that Weimar Republic. His name was Siegfried Krakauer, and he wrote a book later in exile in the U.S., and he was paid by the MoMA. And in the 40s, Hitler was still leading the war in Europe. He wrote this book, From Caligari to Hitler, first in English language, and then later translated to German. And it is, as he called it, a psychological history of German film. And his general idea, he's quite a Freudian thinker, and he studied philosophy before in Europe. So his main idea was that cinema can... is a kind of voice or a kind of seismograph for the unconsciousness or the subconsciousness of collective mind. So in a way, he's reading those films as if they could tell us something which even the people who did the films did not know about what they are telling. So it is a kind of a mirror for social and cultural events, and as well for political things which are happening, political events which will happen.
Not to mention that the film industry in Germany around that time was one of the most important industries in the world.
Yeah, it was. And it was very big as Hollywood in the 20s. And as well, it had a very tight relationship to the international market. First of all, one has to mention that up to 1929, film means silent film, which is very good for an international release because you don't need to translate anything, or you don't need to dub anything. You just need to change the titles in between some few images in the film. So film in that time was quite the most international art at all. And so German films were sold all over the world, not just in the US, as well in Japan, for example. Very influential is the expressionist cinema for Japanese cinema. And but as well, it goes in the other direction, which means that American, English, Swedish, Japanese films were shown in Europe and especially in Germany. Because filmmaking in Germany was, after the war, we had inflation, it was a cheap country, so filmmaking as well has been very cheap. So it was very easy for international producers to make films there, and for the German producers. So what nearly no one knows, and what is not in my film, by the way, is that, for example, such a national epic like Napoleon by Abel Gance, the great French filmmaker, and it is an epic which was, it is 5 hours long, and it was planned to be, I think, 10 films of each 5 hours length. This was financed by German producers. They had a deal, which is a kind of European Union avant la lettre, before it happened politically. So these are just a few examples for what was happening in general there, that German film industry was quite creative, quite productive. They did a lot of so-called B-movies, and the producers like Erich Pommer were big masters of industry and of filmmaking, of film art. And as well, a lot of German filmmakers, they were tempted to go abroad, for example, to the US, like Ernst Lubitsch, who started even in the Kaiserreich, in the German Empire, before First World War, then made some comedies in early Weimar, then went to the US and became one of the most famous comedy directors of Hollywood. Or, for example, a filmmaker like Friedrich Wilhelm Murnau, who started with vampire films like Nosferatu and did some social melodramas. And then he went to the US and did some films there. He died quite early, but he lived the last years of his life in Hollywood. So even before Hitler came to power and we have the great movement of political exile, we have a lot of, as well, stars, actors like Emil Jannings, who is the first Oscar winner for Actors Award, Academy Award winner for the actor, best actor. Or we have Marlene Dietrich and her famous director Josef von Sternberg. They all went out before Hitler came to power. And when Hitler came to power, others followed, like Fritz Lang, like Billy Wilder, like Robert Siodmak, and a lot more.
A mass exodus of so much talent. And one of the points that is made also is that around this time, genre films, a lot of them came out of Germany.
Yeah, a lot of them. People, you know, for me, cinema, of course, is auteur cinema. It means it is art, and it's made by individuals who have their individual technique and handwriting and vision. But this does not mean that a personal vision can't be a fantasy film or a horror movie or a spy story. Look at Steven Spielberg today. And the most interesting, one of the most interesting discoveries for me was when I was looking into the archives and reviewing or sometimes first watching the films of Fritz Lang, that he is the kind of the Spielberg of the 20s because he knows it all. He did small, tiny auteur films, very sensitive, and he did really, you might call them B-movies with science fiction effects, and he did the big epic dramas, and as well he did an adventure series called Spiders in the US. Yeah. We can buy it on DVD, in Germany not. And it was planned for 4 parts. Only 2 were made at the end because he wanted to do something else. But those reminded me immediately to the Indiana Jones adventures. Yeah. So there is a kind of German Indiana Jones. And as well, Siegfried, the famous hero of the first part of the Nibelungen, he is like a German Superman. And so we have fantasy films, but we have as well the first serial killer movie, M., Peter Lorre as well, someone who went to the US and shot a lot of movies there later. So this is a great film, and we have the Mabuse series, a kind of German Fantomas, the evil superhero of criminals who wants to govern the world like a James Bond antagonist. So in a way, we have a lot of those genre films as well invented in Weimar cinema. And what is, I think, kind of a broad knowledge, at least for film buffs, is that the film noir, which is has a French word, but it's American cinema, it was originally inspired by the expressionism and the black and white aesthetics of the silent movies.
Light and shadows.
Yeah, light and shadows.
I have to talk about it. It's a particular point when you mentioned that Italy has Antonioni versus Fellini, and then France has Godard versus Truffaut, and then there's German counterparts as well to that.
Yeah, it is Fritz Lang and Murnau. I think those are the two most important individual film directors, persons with very broad work. And of course, this is a kind of simplification to say it like this. But what I wanted to say in general is that we have cinema as more than just one thing. And it can be tiny auteur cinema or big adventurous cinema, blockbuster cinema. It has as well always something to do with entertainment and spectacle, but in the same moment it has something to do with sensitivity and with secrets and hidden things. So one of the most important points for me was to show that cinema is not just one thing. And to make this point clear, I think like French cinema is the more romanticist attitude of Truffaut and the more rational intellectual attitude attitude of Godard, and both is beautiful, and both liked each other as persons and were friends. Yeah. So in Germany, we have, for example, Murnau, who is a kind of a romanticist filmmaker, quite traditional in his value system, in his taste, but very avant-garde in the techniques he used. And we have Fritz Lang, who is maybe a bit cooler, a bit more rational, but he's a genius as well. And he is interested in always doing something new, never done. And the most interesting thing maybe is that they worked with the same actors, they worked with the same producers and studios, and they worked, of course, with the same cinematographers. The cinematographers of Weimar cinema are so beautiful and they are so underestimated, we don't even know their names. But we should. And someone like Eugen Schifftan, who went to the US later as well, or someone like Karl Freund, for example, who shot with Murnau Faust and with Fritz Lang Metropolis, and who shot as well a movie which is not very well known, Fräulein Else, with Paul Schinner. And this was where I was mentioning Antonioni, because he has a very long shot and one of the first, how do you say this, 90 degrees angle pans yeah, of the camera, because the cameras in that time were very heavy and not much moving, they were just running. And so it was very unusual to bring the cameras to move. And Karl Freund was the guy with the moving camera. Even before the famous film Vertov, the man with the moving camera, even before Karl Freund kind of invented this effect.
Yeah. I mean, we could even talk about Man with the Movie Camera as opposed to Walter Ruttmann's Berlin Symphony of the City. Unfortunately, we don't have time to develop all these things because it's so fascinating, but that will hopefully make people want to watch this film, which I found greatly interesting. But now I would like to know what were your own difficulties in putting the film together and using so much of the footage from the films of the time.
Well, there are, of course, some difficulties if you do a film like this. First of all, I have to say I'm a film critic and I'm not a filmmaker. I never went to film school. This is my first film, so I had to learn a lot of things. Of course, I did not work so much with a camera. I did not work with actors, so it was a bit easier. But in the editing room, it was a huge job. First problem is very easy. It's the reduction. Yeah, you have this 150 films at least, and you have a lot more lost films where we have some photos from, or we have some small extracts, at least 5 minutes length or something like this. And I had to reduce, to cook it to whatever, the mixture of, at the end, I think we have something like 30 to 40 films in this film. So not very much. It's a big reduction. And of course, my film could be a bit shorter, but it could be much longer. And it's always, you say to a director, kill your babies. That's very easy said, but very difficult to do, especially when you are a father and you love your children. So I had to kill a lot of my babies, believe me. And then, of course, it was sometimes difficult to buy the rights. There are not all the films I wanted to have in this movie. There are not all of them in. Sometimes we could not afford the rights. Sometimes we would not get it because there are some rights issues, copyright things. And as well, copyright law is in Europe, in each country, it's a bit different. Each archive has their own rules. In the US, it's very liberal. In Germany, it's very restricted.
You end the film by asking us what does cinema know that we don't know? So I'm going to throw the question back to you. What does cinema know that we don't know?
So I have to answer my own question. Okay. First of all, this question is raised three times in the movie, one at the beginning, one a little bit later, and then again at the end. And I do this, it's the only question I raise three times. I do this, of course, to leave it a little bit to the spectator, to the audience, because the audience should ask itself the question and find an answer for itself. I'm not a director who is thinking he knows all the answers. I think, as well as a critic, sometimes it's more interesting to raise questions and to think it over, because there are no final answers to the films or to Weimar Republic and the politics. But, of course, I think that this question is kind of the essence of the Krakauer book. Krakow suggests that cinema knows a little bit more. It's not absolutely clear what it knows, but it's quite clear that it is, as I said before, reflecting our subconsciousness. So I think the answer to my question is that cinema is a mirror of something like social and cultural knowledge, mass knowledge, and we can read films in the way that behind the story, behind the surface, in the images, sometimes at the sides of the images and not in the center, we can, first of all, see the pure evidence of facts. We can see how the world was looking, how cities used to look, how nature was treated. We can see animals which are dead, and we see, of course, a lot of human beings. Look at the children and people on Sunday. Some of them will still be on Earth as very old persons. But all the others, you see such youth and optimism, and it all died. So cinema knows there are reasons to love life and to be in the same moment a bit melancholic about the fact that we are all will die. And cinema, of course, is the only art which gives us an insight in a past which is gone forever. So it makes us happy and melancholic in the same moment. I think this heartbreaking effect is the purest and most beautiful effect of cinema, and that's what cinema knows.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio. 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.